Marok Podcast tager dig med backstage.
Det er onsdag, og dermed er det vanen tro blevet tid til Marok Podcast. I denne episode kan du møde det eneste tilbageværende medlem af Deep Purple, som har været med hele vejen siden begyndelsen. Hovedpersonen hedder Ian Paice, og er trommeslager gennem mere end 40 år i et af rockhistoriens allerstørste bands. Og i løbet af den næste gode halvtimes tid, kan du høre historien om tilblivelsen af et af de mest ikoniske livealbums gennem tiden, Made in Japan, om dynamikken i det legendariske Mark II-lineup, der blandt andet gav os en rock. Og derudover kommer det også til at handle om det nummer, som allerflest kender Deep Purple for, nemlig Smoke on the Water. Der er mange historier derude om sangen og tilblivelsen af den, men i denne episode får du det direkte fortalt af en af dem, der var der. Selvfølgelig bliver det også tid til en snak om det nye og 21. studiealbum Whoosh, der kom på gaden forleden. Og lad os da lige starte med en sang fra netop det album. Det her er Nothing at All. Jeg hedder Stine Skovgaard. Velkommen til My Rock Podcast.
On the phone right now,
Ian Paice, legendary drummer of Deep Purple, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Ian, the 21st album of Deep Purple, Whoosh, is coming out in August. Congratulations on that one.
Thank you very much. We are enjoying making records again. And since we've hooked up with Bob Ezrin, going into the studio has become a labor of love again, where for a long time it was a labor of work. We sort of did it because we had to, but there was no sort of feeling of looking forward to it. But since we've been in the hands of Mr. Ezrin, recording has become fun again. It's quick, it's vibrant, and we have somebody in control, which any bunch of musicians needs. You know, it's like an army without a general. You know, somebody has to tell you what to do, even with all the experience in the band. You need somebody in the studio who can organize things properly, and Bob does that for us.
I remember talking to Ian Gillan about the previous album called Infinite, and he said very cryptic that that album might be the last Deep Purple album, but now, well, here we are.
Yeah, the big word there was might. It might be the last album. You know, we've got another 10, 11 months with nothing to do, you know, concert-wise. And that's a long time to be sitting around doing nothing. We can do something positive with it. I wouldn't be surprised if in 2 or 3 months' time we talk to each other and say, should we get together and see if we can write some more songs? If we can do that, if we have some more ideas we think are good, there's no reason why we shouldn't pop in the studio again and knock out another record, because that's easy if you have the ideas. If you have no ideas, there's nothing you can do. But, you know, that would not surprise me at all. So the thing that Ian said there, it might be the last record. Well, that's the important word, it might be. We know that touring is getting more and more difficult as people get older. You know, there's other things they want to do and they have to look after their health. But making a record, if you have the creative ideas for new songs, that can go on as long as you want it to go on. As long as you're enjoying it and you're making sounds that people want to hear, and there's no reason why you should stop.
So basically, health is the biggest obstacle at the moment?
Well, for everybody who starts getting to their latter years, you know, we're all sort of 70-something, and Steve's approaching 70. There comes a point where, you know, you have to know that physically you can do it. Rock and roll is not like playing in a little gentle jazz trio. You know, it's very demanding, and you have to have strength to be able to do it. So long as that stays with us, we're good for another 2 or 3 years, I should think, going around the world. So long as we enjoy it. I mean, one guy could turn around and say, "That's it, I've finished. I want to stay at home now." You know, that could happen tomorrow. I don't think it will. I think we still have so much fun on stage, and we still live on stage. You know, when you're on stage, you're playing for people. As much fun as being in the studio is now, you are still playing for a machine, and that is a totally different vibe. And on stage, you can take a chance and know that if you get it wrong, it doesn't matter. It was there and it's gone. When you're in the studio, you're creating something which is going to last forever. So you're in a different mindset, and you try and make sure everything you do is as correct and as perfect as it can be. And that's a different way of playing. You know, it just has to be. You know, you don't want to release a record with something you really hate on it because you didn't play it right. So that's different. But I say, as you get older, you just got to be aware that, you know, things you could do without thinking when you were 20, now you have to think about it a little bit. You know, so as long as you're aware that the world changes and you're a different person than you were 30, 40 years ago, then it's okay. As long as you understand that. You know, at the moment we're having so much fun playing. The very thought of saying this is the last tour, this is the last date, that's a bit scary. I don't ever want to do that.
As you said, when going into the studio, you play to a machine. Well, back in the days, you recorded on tape, and being the legend band that Deep Purple is, being around for more than 40 years, how have things changed when going into the studio? Is it more difficult to do a record these days, or how is it?
It's much easier. Back in the old analog days, you really had to focus on getting everything done in one take. Maybe two takes if the two takes were exactly the same tempo. Remember, in those days, we didn't use click tracks, so it was on the feel of the count when you came in. So if you got the take 95% right, and you had another take which was close enough to it, you could get your razor blade out and cut the tape and stick them together. So, you know, basically, you tried to get it all in one take. Now you don't have to do that. What you can say is, okay, we're going to do three or four takes of it, and with digital editing, we can take the best bit of each take and put them together, and nobody knows. You know, and in the studio, you're dealing in an artificial situation, an artificial medium. So at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how you get the result, as long as you get the result. I've just been editing some video footage of something I want to release fairly soon. And I was trying to use a backing track for the video. It works fine until 2 minutes in. Then I'm playing something different, and I realize that the audio has come from a different take. So now I have to find the video for the different take to make it match up. So, you know, but it's so common these days that in rock and roll especially, not so much in jazz and classical music, but even they do it, what you hear on the final record is often not one take. It's a matter of amalgamating the best bits from three or four takes to end up with the best track. You know, and because it's so easy digitally, that's what happens. And quite honestly, you can get a track done very quickly with this system because you don't have to worry about getting everything perfect in one go. I mean, you try to. I mean, we've released tracks which is just one take. You know, for those 4 or 5 minutes, all five of us got together in the right place and we all played perfectly, and that's great. But they don't happen all the time.
That leads me to one question that I always wanted to ask you. And since you are the only remaining member of Deep Purple who have been with the band for the whole time, mm-hmm. one of the best live albums in the world, Made in Japan. Can you yeah. tell me how much has been reworked after recording? Because when I hear that record, everything is, yeah. well, it's top class.
Nothing was touched on that, and the reason it wasn't touched is because it was basically impossible to do that. We didn't want to anyway. We were really happy with the end result, but it was recorded very simply on an 8-track machine, 1-inch tape, 8-track machine. I think we had 2 tracks for the drums, 2 tracks for the live sound, and the other guys had 1 track each. And we just lifted the faders and maybe added a little top, a little bottom, you know, fiddled with the EQ a little bit, and we left it alone. The thing with the live recording is, back in those days, the spread from all the instruments was so great that you couldn't isolate, say, the drums from the guitar and the guitar from the bass. So if you tried to replace something, you'd always hear an echo of the original thing in the background. So we just said, this is a great little audio document of a great rock and roll band playing really well. We just leave it alone. We just left Martin Birch to get the balance right. So, you know, once we heard the tape, we said, okay, Martin, that's good. We're just gonna mix it and we're gonna leave it alone. So there was absolutely nothing done to those tapes at all.
It's a mark in history.
Yeah, I think it's a great rock and roll document.
Og her skal det så lige tilføjes, at lydmanden og produceren, som vi taler om her, Martin Birch, forlod denne verden den 9. august i år i en alder af 71. Lad os ære hans minde med netop hans lyd. Her fra Made in Japan fra 72, Deep Purple, Highway Star.
I'm
Well, Deep Purple have had a lot of lineups during the years, and Mark II.
Not my fault.
I know.
Not my fault.
but the Mark II lineup stands out with the legendary albums in Rock Machine Head, and as we talked about, Made in Japan. Was this really where Deep Purple took its shape?
Well, I think when you've got a fairly small nucleus of musicians, which most rock bands are, they could be 3, 4, 5 people, not often more than that. But what you get is the only possible solution of those 4 or 5 people working together. It wasn't just us at that time. There was a movement in rock music where 2 or 3 years before, the kids who were playing it weren't really good enough to extend pieces of music and to take a jazz approach and have a free-form approach to it. After all those gigs that we did then, we got pretty good very quickly. So we could start extending the music, we could start pushing ourselves artistically, and that was the movement in rock and roll in the late 60s, early 70s. It gave rise to a lot of other bands. You know, it's a matter of timing. Purple, Zeppelin, Hendrix, Cream, they weren't making 3-minute pop singles anymore. They were saying, we can do more than that. So whatever Purple did was very natural progression. When Ian and Roger came into the band, that changed everything from Rod and Nick in the first band. The way that Ian's voice was, the musical ideas that Roger came up with, and into playing with Richie, that's where In Rock came from. Just the dynamic of the 5 people working together just shifted, and there was no conscious thing about it. That's just what happened. I don't think we've ever made a record where we had a plan, you know. I know when we made In Rock, we tried to make a hard record because we had to get over the orchestral thing we'd done with John at the Albert Hall, because a lot of people were expecting us to turn up with orchestras all the time. And I think we had a subconscious belief in the back of our heads that we had to make a solid rock and roll record. I don't think we even really thought it would come out the way it did. Surprise to all of us.
And then again, in Mark III, Ian left, and most bands would say, well, our lead singer left. Well, what should we do? Should we just hang up at the guitars and get on? You didn't. You drafted David Coverdale, Glenn Hughes, and on came Mark III. And that made a change once again to the sound of Deep Purple. How did you feel again about that?
Well, again, it's the only possible outcome of those 5 people working together. I mean, when we made the first record with Glenn and David, they were like getting a new job. You sort of do as you're told to make sure you know what's going on. So their influences were kept very much under control. By the time you get the second record, they're in the band, they're starting to feel their worth and their strength, and their influences start to come through. And that automatically changes what happens in the final, you know, end product of the music. And that was basically why Richie decided to leave. He didn't want it to go that sort of soul thing that Glenn was bringing and some of the different things that David was doing. Mostly, he didn't want it to change from being a hard rock band. And that's fine, you know, but the 5 of us working together, that's the only way it came out. You know, that's the musical solution we came up with. And there's no conscious thought about changing it. It just changes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he went to form Rainbow, because that way he could be in control of his own destiny and control his own music. But you really have no control over it. It's not like having an orchestra of 85 people. You know, if the second violinist decides to play something different, well, it doesn't really make any difference because you've got 84 other guys doing the same thing. But when you've only got 3 or 4 people or 5 people, if one guy starts changing the direction, you know, it's like driving along the road. You know, you have to follow the road. You have no choice.
Mm.
Of course, so it changes.
Right now, Deep Purple is in Mark 8. Have you at any?
I'm glad I couldn't remember which one it was.
Well, I had to research as well because I couldn't remember of because course. There's been all these reuniting stuff in between. So, yeah. but the original lineup is Mark 8. But have you at any time thought like Richie did? Well, this is not me anymore. I have to get on. Have you had these thoughts?
No, never. Because regardless of who was in the band, apart from me changing some of the things I would play for the good of the music I was playing, I pretty much played the same. Sometimes I played more, and sometimes I played less. But I've always had a great respect for the fact that I've been very lucky. And anybody who has been given that luck, especially in our industry, never treat it with contempt and never think it can come around again. If you've got it, keep on doing it as good as you can and keep it going as long as you can. Because when you start out doing this as a kid, you're doing it to make yourself happy, having fun. When I go on stage now with the drums, 9 times out of 10, I still have a great time. You know, the same way I did when I was a 15-year-old kid. So why would I stop that? And the fact that other people have had problems with each other and decided to leave or been fired, none to do with me. You know, that's my gig, and I do it as well as I can. And I see the benefit of that now, after, you know, all the years I've been with Purple and other artists. I've always given 100% of what I have every night. And an audience will always see that. And if they believe you're trying for them, they will always give you a chance to come back again. And that's all I've ever done. I've been blessed with a great job, and I will never throw it away for no good reason.
Ian, when I say Deep Purple, there's one thing that I think of. That's Smoke on the Water, your signature tune in the broad public. Song that every youngster picking up a guitar for the first time wants to learn to play. How do you...
It drives every music shop mad.
Yeah, that and Stairway to Heaven. But how do you feel being a part of this, well, legend?
Well, it's been with us a long time now, so, you know, it's not something you actually consciously think about. But it's one of those things that you can look back and say, well, as simple as the song is, it's still a very good song. And the concept of telling the story of a recording that went crazy, that's brilliant too. But the simplicity of the riff is what makes it so fabulously, it locks people in straight away. And I've always said this, you know, somewhere in the past, that riff would have been done before in a different style. We've only got so many notes, we've only got so many chords in Western music, and somewhere in the past, somebody will have used it before. But nobody's used those chords in that way to have the same effect. And it's, when we recorded it, we didn't think anything of it. It was just another album track. You know, it was the duh, duh, duh song. And when it went on the album, it fit very, very nicely. But the magic happened when some little guy in Warner Brothers in Los Angeles said, I love this track, but it's too long. And unbeknownst to us, he just got an engineer there, and he chopped it down to 3 minutes, and they released it as a single. They had the single version on one side and the full album version on the other. And that's what woke the world up to Smoke on the Water. And then it had a life of its own.
And you said it yourself, well, there's a special story behind the recordings. There's a lot of stories out on the internet. Well, you were there. What happened?
Well, it was very, very simple. We were ready to record in the casino, which was, because Montreux is a summer town. Like most Swiss places in the mountains are winter towns, you know, for people sliding around on skis. But Montreux is in quite low down by the lake. And in the winter, it closes. And we were going to use that fact that all these, this big place we could record was available. But of course, we were in there watching the last concert of the year, which was Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. And some guy decided it was a good idea to bring a flare pistol to a rock and roll concert and shoot it into the air and burn the place down. So we were stuck with nowhere to record. So our good friend Claude Nobbs, who eventually run the fabulous Montreux Jazz Festival, he found somewhere else for us to work. And we got the record done very, very quickly, and we wouldn't have been able to do it without Claude. And I say at the end of the recording, we didn't have quite enough time on the record. And Richie didn't want to When a Blind Man Cries on the album. He didn't want a ballad on it, so we went, okay. Then we remembered we recorded this backing track, the first thing we'd done, which was a backing track to Smoke on the Water. And then Ian and Roger got together and said, look, we've used all our lyrics up. Why don't we tell a story of the record? And that's how that came together. So, you know, it was chance after chance after chance that made it happen. You know, if the casino had not burned down, most of the record would have been the same. But Smoke on the Water wouldn't have been. So, you know, the town's loss was our gain, if you look at it that way.
Mm. And I actually want to tell you a story. I don't know if you know this, but in Denmark, there's a famous venue called Kobehallen, a big place.
I remember it, yeah.
Yeah. You know, it burned a couple of years ago.
Yeah, very sad about that.
Yeah, you know who played the last show before it burned down?
No, tell me.
Glenn Hughes.
Did he?
Yeah. And you know what the last song he played before shutting down?
Burn.
Yeah.
Gotta be, isn't it?
True story.
Man, yeah. Oh, man, it's serendipity. The way things, when you look back in history, you think, there was a sign there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I remember great gigs at the KB Hall. That was, it was one of those halls you just knew. It wasn't the best hall in the world. But the audience in there made the atmosphere incredible, because it wasn't too big, it wasn't too small, and it was a rock and roll venue. Because some places are and some places aren't. I mean, if you go to, what's that big place in Copenhagen? Well, that's not a rock and roll place. When we used to play in Stockholm at the Icehalla, that was great. You know, it held, 7,000-8,000 people, and it was heaving. But when you played the big Globe, that's like, you can put 60,000 people in there. So if you get 20,000 people in, it looks empty.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the sound is terrible. So there are places that were great to play rock and roll, and the KB Halla was one of those.
Exactly, and that's actually the only place that the Beatles played in Denmark. So
was it?
Yeah, yeah, it was in 64,
I guess.
Good
company then, good company.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Ian Pace, yeah. Our time is up. One last question is, how does the future look for Deep Purple? You've been around for more than 40 years, and you just have a new record coming out. So how does the future look?
Well, like everybody in the world, we are waiting to see what happens with this crazy virus stuff. Everything we had for this year has obviously been cancelled, but luckily we've managed to retain, I would say, 95% of the concerts we were going to do for next year. So we're just praying by next summer that the world has got itself sorted out, because we have to. We can't, you know, there's all this noise about a second wave of the virus. Well, that's fine, and we try and control it. But what do we do in the year's time? So we have to watch out for the fifth wave? It's impossible. Sooner or later, society has to start again, and we have to take our chance. You know, otherwise, what's the point of being here? We're social creatures. We need each other. We need to interact with each other. So sooner or later, this thing will either be defeated, or we just have to get on with life and accept that it's there, like most viruses. So hopefully, we'll be back on the road next summer.
We're looking forward to seeing you here in Denmark. Ian Pace, thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure, man.
Disse var ordene fra Deep Purple-legenden Ian Pace, og dermed også slut på denne udgave af My Rock Podcast. Mit navn er Sten Skovgaard. Tusind tak, fordi du lyttede med. Og jeg håber, du er klar til næste episode, som udkommer næste onsdag. Her stiller vi skarpt på den netop afholdte Wacken Worldwide, verdens største virtuelle rockfestival. På genhør. My Rock. My Rock. Podcast.